Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
Welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World. We are back for our third season. And this season, we are going to look at 10 great battles of the Greek and Roman world. 5 Greek and 5 Roman. And I will point out that some of these battles will involve the Greeks and Romans with other civilizations, notably the Persians, the Carthaginians, and the Germanic peoples. And in each one of these battles, we want to ask, what happened? Why did the battle go the way that it did? What was the role played by leadership, by strategy, by tactics, by the individual soldiers? What motivated them to fight? What was the experience of battle? And what was the significance of the battle? Or the value systems that each side had? What was the role played by honor, by glory, by belief in a political system, by belief in a leader, by fear, by the simple desire to survive and not to be shamed, by training, by custom, by geography? These are all things that we'll look at this season. And I hope that you'll agree with me that these subjects are evergreen, eternally stimulating, and they lead us to ask questions about our world today. We'll begin today with the Battle of Marathon. Marathon lies about 25 miles northeast of the city of Athens, following a route through the foothills of the rugged mountains of the region. Marathon is a flat coastal plain ringed by mountains and ending in a sandy beach. In antiquity, it included marshes. It was the site of one of the most famous battles in history. The Battle of Marathon pitted the heavy-armed infantrymen of Greece against the light-armed soldiers, archers, and horsemen of Persia. Although they were greatly outnumbered by the Persians, the Greeks won. It was surprising, it was bloody, it was brutal, it was one-sided, and it was remarkable because the result inspired the golden age of classical Greece. Marathon is not just a battle, it's a legend. I'm going to quote briefly from a poem by Lord Byron, The Isles of Greece. The mountains look down on Marathon, and Marathon looks on the sea. And musing there an hour alone, I dreamed that Greece might still be free. For standing on the Persian's grave, I could not deem myself a slave. But Marathon is not just a legend. It's a race. As you surely know, a marathon is a long-distance running race, strictly a race of 26 miles and 385 yards, or, if you will, 49.195 kilometers. And Marathon is not just a race. It's a metaphor. To quote the dictionary definition, a marathon is any long-lasting or difficult task or operation of a specified kind. Well, how did we get to all these meanings from the word marathon? Today, we'll find out, and we're going to start by talking about the battle, which took place in the late summer of 490 BC. Many historians accept a date of September 12th. Although a date of August 12th is also possible. Again, we're in the year 490 BC. The questions we want to investigate are, how did the Greeks do it? What was the experience of battle like? Did leadership make a difference? Did the form of government make a difference? And why does Marathon matter today? Well, we'll start with a little bit of background. As I said, the battle took place in the year 490 BC, and about 60 years before that, the Persian Empire was created under the leadership of Cyrus the Great, a tremendous conqueror and king, and a visionary of what an empire could be. Coming from out of southwestern Iran, he creates an empire that ultimately stretches from what is today the border between Pakistan and India, up into Afghanistan, and all the way westward to Egypt and Libya in the south, and to Macedonia and Bulgaria in the north. The empire wasn't all created at once. It took several generations, but Cyrus was the most important person and the founder. And among the people who he conquered were the Greek city-states on the eastern side of the Aegean Sea, city-states located in what is now the Turkish coast and the islands along the Turkish coast. So there were many Greek speakers who came under the rule of the Persian Empire. Cyrus was not only about conquest, but he had a vision of respecting the gods of the various people whom he ruled over. And so it wasn't totally a negative thing to be part of this great and very diverse empire. Now, let's cross the Aegean Sea to Athens, a city located in the Greek peninsula, what is now the modern state of Greece. Athens was a small but important city-state that had been ruled for several generations by tyrants, men who'd started out as popular champions, but had become ever more oppressive over time. The Athenians expelled their tyrants, and then they witnessed a revolution. A revolution in the year 508 BC that established one of the first democracies on earth. The last tyrant of Athens was a man named Hippias, and when he left Athens, he fled for safety to the Persian court, all the way to Iran. So in 508, Athens becomes a democracy. And 2 years later, the Athenians find themselves besieged by other Greek city-states that were troubled by this revolutionary new regime. Democracy was innovative and threatening to many conservative Greek states. Worrying that they were going to be attacked and conquered by the other Greeks, the Athenians sent ambassadors to Persia. And these ambassadors offered the tokens of submission. And those tokens were earth and water. They offered earth and water to the Persians. But when the ambassadors got back to Athens, it turned out the Athenians had solved their problems on their own, and their new energetic democratic army had defeated their enemies. And so the Athenians said to the ambassadors, "We told you to negotiate with the Persians. We didn't tell you to agree to make a treaty with them." And the Athenians disavowed the offer that their ambassadors had made. Well, that insulted the Persians, and even worse, 7 years later, some of the Greek city-states in what is today Turkey rebelled against their Persian overlords, and the Athenians sent 20 warships worth of men to help their fellow Greeks on the eastern side of the Aegean Sea. They marched inland to the Persian capital in this region, the city of Sardis, and the Athenians burned one of the temples in Sardis. And then, fearing Persian retaliation, the Athenians retreated, they went back to their ships, and they went home. The story is told that when the Persian king Darius heard about the burning of Sardis, he reacted. Supposedly, he put the question to the messenger who told him about what the Athenians had done, and he said, "Who are the Athenians?" He didn't even know they were so small and insignificant. When he got an answer, we're told that he took a bow. He fitted an arrow to it and shot it in the sky, and as he sent it up, he prayed, "Zeus, grant me the chance of punishing the Athenians." Having said that, he ordered one of his servants that as often as a meal was set before him, the man should say 3 times, "Master, remember the Athenians." And Darius did remember the Athenians. So 5 years later, in 494 BC, the Persians successfully suppressed the revolt of the Greek city-states along what is now the Turkish coast. And they then prepared to get revenge on the Athenians. It's possible that they sent a first expedition in the year 492 to cross the Aegean, but this expedition was defeated by a storm, and so they came back in force 2 years later in 490. They crossed the central Aegean Sea. They conquered several other Greek city-states that had defied them, and then they turned towards Athens. Now, the Persian force, which was a naval force, consisted of 20,000 men, about 20,000 men, and it was led by two Persian noblemen. Their names were Datis and Artaphernes, to use the Greek versions of their names. And they had along with them an Athenian exile advisor. He was none other than the former tyrant of Athens, Hippias, by now an old man. He'd been in exile from his homeland for about 20 years. And he advised the Persians, and he knew that he still had friends home in Athens and planned to help them to retake the city and to put a tyranny back in Athens in a Persian-friendly regime and to punish the Democrats who had burned Sardis and defied the Persian Empire. His advice was that the Persian expedition not land at the city of Athens. The city of Athens was well fortified, and the Athenians would be prepared for them. Instead, he told them to land 25 miles away from Athens in the northeast part of the country. The country was pretty small. It's about 1,000 square miles in size. So about 25 miles away in the northeast at Marathon. Why Marathon? Well, for two reasons. First of all, Marathon is very flat. It's a plain, and it offers good country for the Persians to use their cavalry. And the Persians were expert horsemen, which the Athenians were not. There's not much flat plain in Attica. It's a rugged land, lots of mountains, lots of hills. So this is unusually good terrain for the Persians. Second reason he wanted the Persians to land at Marathon is that his family came from the Marathon area. This is his home base, and he expected to get a warm welcome when he landed there. So following the advice of Hippias, the Persian expedition lands at Marathon. They have warships, they have light armed troops, they have archers and cavalry. Meanwhile, the Athenians in the city of Athens have to decide what to do. Some of them say, let's just stay at home and take refuge behind our strong walls. Some of them say, perhaps not daring to say it in public, let's surrender, let's negotiate. We can't defeat the Persian Empire. But the opinion that wins out is that the Athenians should fight, and they should send an army to challenge the Persians. Now, Athens had a strong army, but it was not the strongest army in Greece. Everyone knew who had the strongest army in Greece, Sparta. And so the Athenians sent a runner to travel the approximately 150 miles to Sparta, and he made it in record time and asked the Spartans to send an army to help the Athenians. The Spartans said, absolutely, we hate the Persians. We see them as a threat to the freedom of Greece. We'll send an army soon. It turned out that the Spartans were celebrating one of their most important religious festivals, and they could not send an army. This was a time that was dedicated to the gods. So the Spartans said, we'll be there in about 10 days. You hold the fort in the meantime. Were the Spartans serious about this? Probably, because they were very religious. But there is an element of doubt that maybe the Spartans were waiting to see what was going to happen before they committed themselves. The Spartans did not like sending their men far from home into what might be an extremely dangerous situation, since the Persians had a fearsome reputation as warriors. Okay, so the Athenians needed men. So they did two things. First, they asked their neighbors for help, and they actually got help from a city-state that was just north of Athens, just on the other side of the mountains, a place called Plataea. Plataea was a small place that was often threatened by its big neighbor further north, Thebes. And so the Plataeans were anxious to make friends with the Athenians, hoping and knowing that the Athenians could protect them from the Thebans on another occasion. So they sent troops. The other thing that the Athenians did was they scoured their own country for manpower, and they made a remarkable decision. They decided to arm slaves. Now, the entire system of ancient society, so the Greek society was a slave-owning society. Although Athens was a democracy, paradoxically, it was also a society that owned slaves. The first, but alas, not the last time this would happen in human history. And the Athenians, like other Greeks, liked to pretend that slaves were not fit to serve as fighting men, that only free men could serve as fighting men. They also thought it was dangerous. They thought it was dangerous to arm slaves. But on this occasion, the Athenians felt they needed every man they could get. And so they armed slaves. As a result, they end up having an army of about 9,000 infantrymen, as well as 800 allies who came from Plataea. So about 10,000 infantrymen to fight against the Persians. And we think the Persians had about twice as many men, about 20,000 men. So the Athenians march through the hills to Marathon, about 25 miles away from the city of Athens. And their army encamps in the southeastern part of the plain of Marathon. The Persians are camped in the northeastern part of the plain of Marathon. The Athenians are camped in the foothills of the very steep mountains that ring the plain. The Persians are camped near the beach where their ships are beached. Between them, there are marshes. And so getting from one place to another is not entirely easy, but it is doable. And the two armies look at each other and they stay. They don't fight. In fact, for 5 days, they don't fight. Why not? Well, for the Athenians, the answer is pretty easy. The Athenians are waiting for the Spartans with their mighty army to come and provide help. Why don't the Persians attack, however? Well, the Persians fight a very sophisticated way of war. The Persian way of war is not simple. And the Persians know very well that it's cheaper to win a battle, cheaper and less bloody to win a battle by suborning treason on the other side than by actually having to fight. And the Persians have a long track record of negotiating and finding traitors. The Persians sit on a very, very wealthy treasury, using money to bribe people to win them over and to get the enemy to defeat himself, as it were. With Hippias along, the Persians believe, quite rightly, that there is a faction in Athens that would rather negotiate than fight. And so we might imagine that the Persians are waiting for the Athenian army to crack up under the pressure of fighting the Persians. The Athenians are not eager to fight the Persians. They're afraid of them because the Persians have created this great empire. The Persians have cavalry, which the Athenians do not. The Persians are great archers, and the Athenians are not great archers. The Greeks, in general, are not great cavalrymen or archers. The Persians have a significant navy, and the Athenians do not. The Persians have no mobility. They can take their ships, sail around Attica, sail around the Cape in the south, and go to the west side and attack the city of Athens. So the Athenians have lots of reasons to wait, except the Athenians have strength as well. Now, the titular leader of the Athenian army is a man named Callimachus. He is the so-called war archon, the person who, in theory, is in charge of the army. However, the Athenians also have a board of 10 generals who are elected by the Athenian people, and they share command. All 10 generals are with the army. And one of those generals is the man who, by force of personality and ambition and experience, is the real leader of the Athenian army at Marathon. His name is Miltiades. Let me tell you about Miltiades, because he's a remarkable person. Miltiades was an Athenian aristocrat and an adventurer, something of an ancient Sir Walter Raleigh. Now, Miltiades came from a family that had done business with the Persians for more than one generation. They ran their own colony, believe it or not, on the eastern side of the Aegean, on the northeastern Aegean Sea, on the Gallipoli Peninsula, what is today the Dardanelles or the Hellespont. Miltiades' brother had been in charge of that colony. It was a very violent place, and his brother had been killed by an axe blow to his head. Miltiades learned that in order to succeed, you had to be strong, you had to be tough, you had to lie, you had to cheat. You also had to know how to deal with the Persians. The Persians were his overlords. They controlled this part of the world. And he technically, although an Athenian citizen, was a vassal of the Persian Empire. In fact, he took part in an invasion of Ukraine and southern Russia that was led by Darius, about 15 years earlier, in 513 BC. This invasion led to a stalemate. It wasn't the success that Darius had wanted, but he did make his point against the Scythian raiders. After this, Miltiades came back to Athens, and he rose in the politics of the young democracy. He was successful because, not only because he was knowledgeable and ambitious, but also because he had the ability to think outside the box, to think the unthinkable. And Miltiades' thought in the lead up to the Battle of Marathon was that the Athenians could do it, that the Athenians could defeat the Persians. He knew the Persians, and he knew the Greeks had something that the Persians did not. The Greeks didn't have cavalry, they didn't have archers, but they did have heavy armed infantrymen who knew to fight together in a unit. And Miltiades believed that with enough of them, and if they were determined and clever, they could defeat the Persians. So let me tell you a little bit about these Athenian infantrymen who were typical of the Greek infantrymen of the period. We call them hoplites because one of their weapons was a shield, a hoplon, and they fought in a unit that we call the phalanx. The phalanx was a unit of closely massed heavy infantrymen, and we call the whole thing together the hoplite phalanx. Now, let me tell you a little bit about their equipment. Each member of the phalanx, each hoplite, would hold a large body shield in his left hand. His left arm would go through a thong holding this body shield, and it weighed between 7 and 15 pounds. He would wear a helmet of a little over about 2.5 pounds, a breastplate, depending on what it was made of. Some were metal, most probably were not, weighing between 8 and 15 pounds, shin guards or greaves that weighed about 3 pounds. His most important weapon was a spear, a pike, not a throwing spear, but a thrusting spear. This weighed a little over 3 pounds, and a spear was between 7 and 9 feet long. I'll tell you a bit more about the spear in just a moment. A hoplite would also carry a sword, which was definitely his secondary weapon. This weighed between 3 and 4 pounds. He'd have some other clothing as well. So we get a total of between about 28 and 45 pounds. Now, this is a revised argument, and earlier scholars thought that a hoplite would be carrying weapons, arms and armor, that would weigh as much as 70 pounds. But new and, to my mind, convincing research shows that the armor and arms was lighter, so between 28 and 50 pounds. So we're talking at about what is at a maximum of about one-third of a man's body weight, assuming that a man would weigh about 150 pounds. And we know that the Greeks were somewhat smaller than a typical European would be today. So we've got these heavy-armed infantrymen, the hoplites, and as I said, they're wearing armor that protects them, and they're carrying this big shield that offers very effective protection. They fight in a unit in which each man can huddle up to the man next to him and get protection from that shield. The phalanx would be about 8 files deep, and well, how long it would be would depend, but a unit in which there's maybe 60 men long might be a typical one, and you'd have these building blocks that could make a bigger and bigger army. It's essential for this phalanx to work effectively that the men train together. They need a great deal of training. I should also say that this weaponry isn't cheap. And not every man in Athens could afford to be a heavy-armed infantryman. The poorest men couldn't. They had to fight as light-armed men or not fight at all, or maybe just accompany the army and throw rocks or cheer it on. Slaves certainly couldn't afford these kinds of weapons, but there is a group of people in society, farmers of medium wealth, who form the backbone of this hoplite army. Their main weapon, as I said, is their pike. And what happens in battle is that fighting as a unit, they take their pike and thrust over and over and over again, with the men in the back pushing and encouraging the men in the fight. And two Greek hoplite phalanxes would come up against each other. And by dint of their training, their fitness, their weaponry, their toughness, one would break through the other. It's pretty simple. It's not immensely sophisticated. And the question at Marathon is, could it defeat the Persians? The Persians have archers who can do enormous damage. And they've got cavalry who can go up against the sides of the phalanx and who could unbalance the phalanx and maybe even break it up. The Athenians have very little cavalry, very few horses to protect the flanks of their phalanx. And that was the question. Miltiades believed the Athenians could do it only if they had enough men, which is why he was in favor of arming the slaves and why the allies were so important. But the other Greeks were not so sure. Well, so there's a stalemate in the Greek army. They're not moving. They're not attacking the Persians. And then, on the fifth day, the Greeks decide to attack. Why did they make this decision? Why did they suddenly decide to attack the Persians, even though the Spartans are not there? It's still the Athenians, slaves, and the Plataeans. Why did they decide to attack? Well, we get a clue from a later text, an erratic Byzantine encyclopedia written centuries later. And this erratic Byzantine encyclopedia has a proverb called cavalry apart. Cavalry apart. What does it mean? So they explain the cavalry left. When the Persians were ready for retreat, the Greeks from the Persian Empire climbed the trees and gave the Athenians the signal that the cavalry had left. And when Miltiades realized that, he attacked, and so he won. From there comes the above-mentioned quote, which is used when someone breaks ranks before battle. Now, what does this mean? Well, scholars have debated it, and what it seems to mean is that the Persians decided to take their cavalry away. Why would they do that? Why would they take their cavalry, which is one of their best weapons, and remove it from the battlefield? Because they were re-embarking the cavalry on the ships. And why were they re-embarking the cavalry on the ships? Well, we might guess that the reason they decided to do that is they decided that the Greeks at Marathon weren't going to break after all, that the Greeks weren't going to lose their morale, that no traitor was going to break up the ranks. And instead, the thing to do was to sail around the Attic Peninsula, to sail around Cape Sunion and to get to the city of Athens before the Greek army at Marathon could, and hope that traitors would open the gates there. Miltiades got the news, if we believe the source, if we believe the story we get from this Byzantine encyclopedia. It's called the Suda, by the way, in case you're interested. If we believe what the Suda says, Miltiades now was in command of the Athenian army, and he showed the hand of a very thoughtful general. He ordered the Greeks to make their line thin, to protect their flanks, to protect their line themselves from being outflanked. In the center, they were only four files deep instead of the usual eight. The flanks are a little deeper than usual. On each flank, the files are nine men deep. We get an account of the battle from our best source, the Greek historian Herodotus, who lived slightly afterwards and who's known as the father of history. Herodotus says, and I quote, "The lines were drawn up and the sacrifices were favorable. So the Athenians were permitted to charge and they advanced on the Persians at a run. There was not less than eight stades in the no man's land between the two armies." That's about 1 mile. Whoa, let's take a pause here. Herodotus says that the Athenians begin the battle by running at the Persians. They are running a mile. They're carrying perhaps up to 50 pounds of arms and armor, and they run a mile. There's been a lot of skepticism as to whether they could have done this, and there have been many tests done with college athletes and soldiers and even middle-aged scholars. And the consensus seems to be it ain't easy, but it's doable. But why would the Athenians do this? Why would they run? Why would they begin the battle by running a mile? Well, I think there are two reasons why they would do it. The first is shock. They wanted to shock the enemy. They wanted to unbalance the enemy. And as we know, surprise is a force multiplier. The second, much more practical, the Persians have arrows. And if the Greeks move slowly, they will be, as it were, sitting ducks for the arrows. Yes, their shields will protect them, and their armor will protect them some as well, but it can't offer complete protection. Running is the most effective protection against the archers. Okay, let's continue the story in Herodotus. The Persians, seeing them coming at a run, made ready to receive them. But they believed that the Athenians were possessed by some very desperate madness, seeing their small numbers and the running to meet their enemies without support of cavalry or archers. That is what the Persians thought. But the Athenians, when they came to hand-to-hand fighting, fought very worthily. They were the first Greeks we know of to charge their enemy at a run, and the first to face the sight of the Persian dress and the men who wore it. For till then, the Greeks were terrified even to hear the names of the Persians. So the two armies clashed, and we know that when ancient armies clashed, the result was brutal. Just imagine the physical force needed to take a pike and to thrust with it again and again and again. Now, I must tell you something about the Persian infantrymen who faced the Greeks. The Persians were a very well-organized military force. There was nothing amateur about them. They did not, however, have heavy armed infantrymen. The Persians prided themselves on their cavalry and also on their light armed troops. Their shields were smaller and lighter than the Greek shields. They did not wear metal armor. They were mostly wearing cloth armor. And they had javelins and swords. Although they sometimes did have pikes, they had nothing like the training in fighting together that the Greek military did. So, let's go back to Herodotus. What happens when you have these men in heavy armor versus men in lighter armor, albeit men with archers to reinforce them? The two sides fought a long time at Marathon, Herodotus says. In the center of the line, the foreigners prevailed, where the Persians and their allies from Central Asia were arrayed. The foreigners prevailed there and broke through in pursuit inland. But on each wing, the Athenians and Plataeans prevailed. In victory, they let the routed foreigners flee, and they brought the wings together to fight those who had broken through the center. So imagining the Greeks defeating the enemy on the wings, coming together, turning, and defeating the enemy who had broken through their center. There'd be heavy fighting there. And then Herodotus says, the Athenians prevailed, then followed the fleeing Persians and struck them down. When they reached the sea, the Greeks demanded fire and laid hold of the Persian ships. We can only imagine the horror that took place as the Persians fled, trying to get back to their ships. And many of them had to flee through the marshes. As I said, it's very marshy territory there. The marshes have been drained in modern times. And we know that many men lost their lives in the muck of the marshes. We also know the place where the hardest fighting happened, because the Athenians buried their dead on the spot. They did not usually do this. The Greeks did not usually do this in warfare. They would cremate the dead and bring the bones home. The tomb of the Athenian dead, believe it or not, still stands. It still exists today. You can visit it. And it stands nearly 30 feet high. The Athenians got to the ships, and they tried to capture the Persian ships. They actually capture 7 Persian ships, but the rest of the Persian ships get away. And where do they go? Do they cross the Aegean Sea and go back to Persia? Not a bit of it. As they put off from the shore of Marathon, a shield signal was seen in the mountains above Marathon in this late summer morning. The Greeks were convinced that this is a signal from an Athenian traitor saying, hurry, Persians, go to the city of Athens, round the Cape, and we will open the gates to you. And that's precisely what the Persian navy proceeded to do. Unfortunately for them, the Greek army at Marathon caught its breath and immediately returned to the city of Athens. This time probably taking even a shorter way, a shorter but steeper way through the mountains in order to get home as quickly as possible. And when the Persian fleet arrived in Phaleron Bay outside the city of Athens, they were disappointed to find that the Athenian army had already made it home and was there to defend the walls of Athens against the enemy. Now, the Persians suffered massive casualties at Marathon. 6,400 men were dead, plus an unknown number lost in the marshes. We know this because a day or two later, the Spartan army showed up, and the Athenians were proud to show off the number of Persians who were dead. As for the Athenian casualties, well, the numbers were very lopsided. The Athenians only had minimal losses, only 192 dead. The Plataeans had 11 dead, so a little over 200 men dead. I should say that we know that in ancient battles, having lopsided casualties is not that unusual, because usually what happens in an ancient battle, the two sides fight, and when one of them breaks through, the other side runs as fast as it possibly can to escape. And that's when the real killing zone is opened up. That's when the victorious side really comes after the side that's been defeated. So this casualty number, well, ancient sources do have a way of exaggerating. A very lopsided number of casualties of the Greeks versus the Persians is only to be expected. Among the dead, there are some distinguished men. Callimachus, as I said, he is the de facto leader of the Athenian army. He was killed in the fighting by the Persian ships. And another Athenian general, one of Miltiades' colleagues, a man named Stesilaus, is also killed. Finally, the brother of the playwright Aeschylus. Aeschylus is the pioneering tragic playwright, the first writer of tragedies that we have in the history of the world. Aeschylus fought at Marathon, and so did his brother. And his brother got to the Persian ships and gripped a Persian ship and then had his hand chopped off by an enemy, and he died. Now, it's a Greek victory. The Persian navy has to go back to cross the Aegean Sea. Hippias knows he is never going to go back to Athens. And what are the results? The Athenians are ecstatic that they are the first Greeks to have defeated the Persians in battle. And the Greeks called the Persians barbarians. Of course, the Persian Empire, one of the most civilized, sophisticated civilizations in history, was not barbarian. The Greek used the term barbarian as a generic term of derision for against foreigners. Supposedly, it comes from this idea that the foreigners sounded like sheep, bleating, going ba, 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 which is why the Greeks called them barbarians. The Greeks themselves respected the Persians in many ways, but that's a longer story. So the Greeks, Athenians, thrilled about this, considered it a great victory, celebrated in their legend, in their art, in their culture. And many historians have called Marathon one of the most decisive battles in history. Now, strictly in military terms, that's not true. It's not decisive. The Persians do not consider themselves defeated by the Greeks. In fact, they use Marathon as an excuse to build a bigger and better armada, and they come back to invade Greece with it 10 years later. The war between the Greeks and Persians is not over, not by a long shot. So in military terms, Marathon is not decisive. In cultural and political terms, however, it's a different story, because in cultural and political terms, Marathon unleashes the confidence of classical Greece. As I said, Athens is a young democracy. It's a regime that has grown up in the shadow of revolution. Athenian democracy is only 18 years old at the time of Marathon. And the Athenians know very well that Marathon saved democracy. If it had gone the other way, if the Persians had won, they would have reinstalled a tyranny in Athens under Hippias and his family. The Persians liked to do business with tyrannies in Greek city-states. They weren't bad guys. They just thought it was cleaner to do business with a regime run by one man instead of by a large number of people. So Marathon saved democracy, and it's tremendously important in that way. It might allow us to pardon the statement of John Stuart Mill, the English political philosopher of the 19th century, who once said, and I quote, "The Battle of Marathon, even as an event in English history, is more important than the Battle of Hastings." Now, the Greeks had many legends about Marathon. One of them is that a runner ran back from the battle to inform the people in the city of Athens what had happened and to prepare them for the Persian fleet. He ran the 25 miles at absolute top speed. He got to Athens and informed the leaders, "Nenikekamen, Nenikekamen, we have won." And then supposedly he dropped dead from his exertion. Now, this story is not contemporary. It only comes hundreds of years later, and it was probably, alas, a legend that had been embroidered. Legend or not, Marathon has long been associated with races. There was no ancient Marathon race, but when the Olympics were revived in 1896 in Athens, the first modern Olympics took place in Athens, the organizers created a long-distance race from Marathon to Athens, a race of 24.8 miles. But as you know, a marathon race is 26 miles and change, or 42 kilometers and change. How come? Well, in 1908, when the Olympics took place in London, the race began at Windsor Castle, and it ended at a stadium in London that was 26 miles and 385 yards away from the starting place. And that's why the modern marathon race is longer than the actual distance between Marathon, the battle site, and the city of Athens. Now, the Greeks buried their dead in two tumuli, two mounds on the battlefield, and they celebrated their victory in poetry and in art, and they were very proud of what they have done. I want to end, though, not with the Greeks. I want to end with the Persians. And you might have noticed that I haven't quoted any Persian sources on the Battle of Marathon. I wish I could. But unfortunately, the Persians don't leave us any sources about the battle. We're able to make some indirect statements about the Persian army, about Persian tactics, and about Persian society from other sources that we have. But the Persians did not write history, per se, not the way the Greeks did. So we don't have their version of what happened. Instead, I'm going to have to leave you with a modern poem about the Battle of Marathon. It's a poem that looks at the battle in perspective and says, well, it was a great thing for the Greeks, but, you know, Persia was a mighty empire, the largest empire the world had seen at this point in human history. And the Persians could afford to shrug their shoulders at a defeat. So let me read to you this poem. The poem is written by Robert Graves, the well-known English author, and it's called The Persian Version. Truth-loving Persians do not dwell upon the trivial skirmish fought near Marathon. As for the Greek theatrical tradition, which represents that summer's expedition, not as a mere reconnaissance in force, by three brigades of foot and one of horse, their left flank covered by some obsolete light craft detached from the main Persian fleet. But as a grandiose, ill-starred attempt to conquer Greece, they treat it with contempt, and only incidentally refute major Greek claims by stressing what repute the Persian monarch and the Persian nation won by this salutary demonstration, despite a strong defense and adverse weather. All arms combined magnificently together. Thank you for listening today and for sharing one of history's most famous engagements, the Battle of Marathon. I really enjoyed having this chance to talk about it with you. Please like us on iTunes, and if you are so moved, write a review. Please join me next time when we'll talk about another great legendary encounter between the Greeks and Persians, Thermopylae.
Theme music by Lush Life.